have a rather full evening for you this, this session. We won't be doing walking meditation. We'll have another guided meditation in its place. But I want to start the evening with a half an hour of sitting, as we normally do. So please take the posture which is comfortable for you. If you're on a chair, making sure that your back is not resting upon the back of the chair, but swinging free, and your legs are parallel to one another, your feet are parallel to one another, not crossed. And if you're on the floor, that your shoulders are square, your back is straight, and as you come in, you release the need to have to regurgitate the day, to play the day over. Just let the day fall away. Let it just release your need to go over the day. So you just allow yourself to come in here with a kind of fresh and newness that's rare for many of us. As soon as you do, you'll see that there's something else available to you when you're not just lost in your narrative, that there's a new available opening to what is actually occurring. And you'll find your senses become awake to what is actually taking place, perhaps to the temperature of the room, perhaps to whatever sounds are around you. And so as we settle into ourselves. And it's very important to understand meditation is not, we're not trying to become something or someone. We're not trying to add anything. We're simply trying to adjust ourselves sufficiently so that we can see clearly what is already there. We're not trying to see anything special. We just don't want to see things in the distorted way that we naturally and normally do. And what distorts our perception is our thinking about what it is that we're seeing. And we get confused about what we're seeing as opposed to what we're thinking about what we're seeing. So when we look through our thoughts at what we're seeing, we see what our thoughts tell us is there, not what is really there. So meditation is knowing those two separate processes of mind, the thinking and the actual perception, as being vastly different from one another. Even though as we begin to focus on our attention on our body has a lot of judgment, a lot of overlap with thinking. We have opinions about virtually every part of our body. And so when our attention touches those areas, we come with the memory of what that area has meant to me. And to get a sense of the impact that that has, we need to know that there are a lot of things going on. There's the speaking, the talking that we have mentioned, and we'll mention further, especially next week. But there's also an emotional element that's often covering and persuading the conversation in a certain attitudinal way. To be aware that that emotional overlay is present to your perceptions. And just know the difference between what you're perceiving, the body as the body, and the emotional overtone that we, in memory, have offered that particular part of the body, or the body as a whole. So what we want to do to start our meditation is to deeply relax, which releases the tension associated with our attitudes. So softening the head area and the eyes, so that the eyes are not clenched, but rather just soft. Releasing the tension in the brain itself so that there's a sense of lightening up that area and not clenching our teeth, so relaxing the jaw area. and dropping the shoulders away from the neck. Tucking the chin into the neck a little bit so your head isn't floating sort of out there. And then as you bring your attention more into the trunk of the body, just noticing the rhythmic sensations of what the body goes through with each breath. There's the inhalation and the body expands in inhalation. And you can feel that as a physical sensation. And as the body releases the air, there's a contraction in the belly and the chest. And also can be felt in the nose tip. It's a beautiful sensation to rest our attention upon because it's not asking anything from us. Breath, for the most part, doesn't usually have a lot of emotion with it. We're just breathing. For some people who have early childhood memories of drowning, it can be different, but if that's not your case, then don't worry about that. That's just your breath, just the physical sensations of your breath. Don't be anxious about it because you are breathing with or without your will. You just want to be present as you're breathing, like a raft on the ocean. All the ripples that the water holds, you're picking up. From just lying on the raft and being present. Then, as other physical sensations compete with the breath, take your attention and place it upon that competitive sensation. It can be a pleasant sensation, sometimes feelings of warmth or well-being or it can be an unpleasant sensation like an itch or pain. It can be either pleasant or unpleasant, or it can just be a neutral sensation like a tingling sensation. It doesn't matter. If it competes with your breath, then just take it and place it, your attention upon that. Remember to move to each new sensation with that same degree of relaxation and ease that you were offering the breath. And as you get lost in thought, doesn't matter how long you've been lost in thought, just whenever you realize that that has occurred, be willing to release your need to continue to think and bring your attention back to the physical sensation. We're looking at the difference now. It's a very important learning the difference between the breath and what we think is going on, that commentary that seems to parallel all of our experiences. We're not interested in the commentary. We're interested in the life as it's being lived, which comes through the senses. Then last week we included emotions. So that if while we're sitting, an emotion should arise that takes our attention away from the breath. Again, it can be a pleasant emotion like happiness or joy or well-being or contentment or whatever. Or it can be an unpleasant emotion, anger, frustration, impatience, fear, grief, loneliness. It doesn't matter, just knowing it's there, knowing it's present without trying to exclude it or look away from it or make more out of it than what it is. It's simply this much. That's all it is. It's this much. So don't add anything to make it more than the experience of having it. Don't add any content to it. Just see what's there, be present with it, usually as a body sensation, and then when it becomes less predominant, you can return to whatever is predominant within your experience. I mentioned last week about the five hindrances that often arise within the practice. Sometimes you'll get all five in the course of the sitting. Sometimes there'll be one that's predominant. And just to remember that those deeply ingrained and conditioned patterns of mind our desire, wanting, that leaning into the experience. We're leaning into an experience that isn't present, wanting something to occur that isn't, not wanting, which is usually not wanting something that is occurring, the pain in your knee, the itch, or the emotion you might be having. So you're aware that there can be an emotion and there can be a hindrance associated with that emotion. Desire, aversion, sleepiness, which I really don't have to remind people about because it's often very much a part of the early practice experience. So you want to stand up to dissipate that sleepiness or take a very formal posture, a very firm and formal posture, but not to give in to the sleepiness. Restlessness, which is that turbulent mind, worrying pattern of planning, thinking. Oh, and restlessness is restlessness. Labeling, knowing what it is there, knowing, recognizing what it is that's coming through us. Desire, oh, desire. Impatience, restlessness, whatever it might be. Give it a single word. And if it doesn't come, that's fine. The word's not important. The experience of it is. And there is doubt, that fifth hindrance, which has you doubting whether you can do this or whether it's worth doing. And if that catches you, then you'll find that you have no energy to move forward in the practice at all. So be very aware that doubt is arising whenever it does. Now this evening, I'm going to continue expanding the field of our attention to include sound. So just for a moment, just listen to sound as it's arising, or perhaps the absence of noise is also a sound, the sound of silence. Sound of the heater. Sound of my voice. What the ear hears is what we're interested in, not what we each think about what we hear. That's the extra, that's the content. So be careful that you just hear what the ear hears and not add anything to it. You don't hear that it's a motorcycle or that it's a car. You hear the sound of that. Because once you've located it with a word, motorcycle, then you have, why is this pretty, you have a whole story that accompanies that, that is necessary and untrue. So don't let yourself move out into an elaborative response. Just hear what is right here to hear. Now it's very helpful sometimes to start with sound, especially if there's a lot of energy in your sitting or there's a lot of tension perhaps in your day, and you can just sit down and you can open up to just sound, starting with just sound, and that gives you some breadth, expanse, some space, so that you can settle down within that space, just listening to what's there. And then as you settle, then you can move into the sensations of breath or emotions or other physical sensations. Very simple, very relaxed, at ease with oneself. Now be quiet and we'll sit for the next 15 minutes in silence. So ending the sitting with a poem by Derek Walcott entitled, To One Who Has Seen and Understood. Tread gently when you walk into my life. For around the body of my soul I have gathered fragile gossamer to the floor of little lies, not to deceive you, but to protect me. Do not pull at them to render my soul naked, for they hide truths I have not yet the strength to face. And when they are gone, I may perish. In the cold realities of your judgment, I may die. But let me stand protected yet a while. Talk to me in love. And when I'm secure in that, those lies will fall away as unneeded peel, revealing the fruit, the feast. As the sound tapers, just gently allow your eyes to open. Don't try to bring yourself back to the harshness of your reality prior to the meditation, but let your body be soft and relaxed, and let your eyes just see very gently what is in front of you. Tonight is going to be a talk on compassion in the heart, and I hope to bring what I have been saying together with the natural compassionate spirit that we all intrinsically have within us, but we often don't recognize for reasons that I will talk about. But I'm going to start with a little science. There are neurons, I understand, within our brain that are called mirror neurons, and they are what make you enjoy a movie. And that is that when you see someone performing an act, you have the same experience as if you were performing that same act. In other words, you have the same neurological response. And so that allows us to have an empathetic response to whatever is being done in front of us. And it also ties in yourself to a greater sense of the community at large. So when you're walking down the street or you see something happening to someone, you empathetically feel that same response as if that event or activity was happening to you. Now, that's a very significant neuron, I must say. And it's the reason I presented the homework that I have, where I'm suggesting that you don't avoid pain for the course of this week and perhaps ongoingly, because I want you to experience the empathetic, the natural, organic, empathetic mirror neurons response to everyday life. I want, when you read the paper, because it doesn't have to come from actually seeing someone, it could come from interpreting a particular story where a child is lost or abused or whatever might be happening. You will also have an empathetic response to that. And you'll see that you're much more tied in, and we are all much more tied into the fabric of life through this interchange of feelings and emotions and empathetic responses than we might imagine. In fact, there is a natural tendency in us all to feel compassion and when we are experiencing or seeing pain in another person. That's not an artificially induced response. That's what naturally occurs to us, is that the response to suffering in the world is a compassionate feeling in ourselves. So if that's an organic and natural relationship that we have to seeing pain, why is there so little compassion in the world? Because there's certainly a lot of pain out there. The reason is that we don't allow that empathetic response to occur. We intervene. One of the ways we intervene is through our personal narrative. You see, it's very difficult to feel the suffering that's in front of us. And so we tell ourselves stories on why that person deserves to feel what they're feeling, and therefore we don't have to feel vulnerable with them. And we keep this commentary going to such an extent that we often don't feel much for anyone, because we've rationalized all of the occurrences that are in front of us as being deserved in some way. Even the responses that we have, the painful responses that we have intrinsically in ourselves, the self-pain, the pains of the knee, the emotional pains, the traumas, we don't really connect with those either, because we're so hard on ourselves within our commentary that we don't allow ourselves to feel the natural compassionate response that is there. So you can begin to sense why our meditation intervenes here. Because what we are learning to do is to quiet ourselves so that we're not turning away from the pain through another source of the commentary. We're not explaining the pain away, which is our tendency to do. It's very difficult to feel vulnerable when we feel pain without the accompanying sense of blame that we associate with seeing pain. You deserve that, or no wonder you got that, or whatever it might be. Each of us have to feel vulnerable. Instead, we have to feel vulnerable. The mirror neuron effect of feeling what someone else is feeling is that we also feel the vulnerability of having felt that. Vulnerability is a tremendously important quality of mind to begin to settle ourselves within. It is the source of love. It is the source of compassion. If we're unwilling to feel vulnerable, we will have cut ourselves off from that very nurturance of love. Let me give you an example. Like most of you, I was on the internet in 2001, September 11th, 2001, and I saw that the Twin Towers were being bombed, or planes were colliding into them, and I turned on the television just as the second plane was crashing into the second tower. And in that explosion, I remember feeling a tremendous mirror neuron, empathetic response for what must be like to be embalmed in that temple, in that building. And the heart, tremendously vulnerable in that moment. But then, you see, because it's very hard to be vulnerable, the immediate response, which allows us to gain control of that vulnerability, is to then seek revenge or anger instead of staying with the vulnerability, which would allow that sense of connection to move into a different level of response. The revenge element, the anger element, takes over, because then you're not vulnerable anymore. Now you're strong, you're on top of everything, and you're in control. And so the vengeance that is the reaction to the vulnerability says, we've got to get whoever did this, you know, or we've got to make sure this never happens again. May I say that all of our reactions to being vulnerable, those are the hardened emotions, the difficult and unpleasant emotions of impatience, of annoyance, of frustration, of anger and fear that we all feel, they're all reactions to being vulnerable. You see? And so if we're not willing to be vulnerable, you can be assured, if you want to remain in control, that you will then have one of these very, may I say, contaminated emotions, reactive emotions, that put you more firmly in control of what you think you need to do, but what you need to do from those hardened emotions are often brutal, reprehensible, and very separate and distant, not connected. Now, I'm not suggesting that wise action needs to occur when people bomb us. I'm not suggesting that we just be passive to that and feel a vulnerability. But because vulnerability isn't passive. It's not where you just lie back and let anyone do whatever they're doing to you. In fact, a more assertive response does occur. But it doesn't create the kind of separation that the hardened response would. So the question then becomes, am I willing to feel vulnerable? Because that's really at the crux of our willingness to settle with love and compassion and some of the qualities of love, like kindness, generosity, gratitude, that accompany that. All of those benevolent emotions arise from that sense of vulnerability. It's very interesting, I think, because it took me a long time in practice to understand that. And when I did, I thought, oh, this is it. This is the reason. This is what's going on. See, love doesn't give us, it doesn't give us an empowerment. It leaves us wide open. It doesn't solve the problem in front of us like anger does. Anger solves the problem by force of will. And yet it just keeps creating the reaction of anger in the opposite. Your angry response creates that mirror neuron's response in the person you're angry at. And it just keeps moving in that direction. And love creates a very different mirror neurological response. When that vulnerability can be sustained. Tenderness, sensitivity. You see, most of us have a dislike for those words because even as I mention them, they feel as if they're disempowering, which they are, personally disempowering. They feel like you're surrendering something that is very important to you. Your self-determination, or whatever it might be. And yet, all spiritual practices have to move through that door. All spiritual practices, if they are authentic, have to go through the vulnerability door. There's no other way to experience the true meaning of life from a non-separate view, from a distorting perceptual view. There's no other way. In the New York Times, some time ago, there was a book review of a book entitled A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit. And the title of the rather long book review was called In the Face of Catastrophe, A Surprise. And what this woman did was she went into disaster areas like Katrina and earthquakes and floods and tsunamis. And she went right in the heart, went and did her research right in the heart of the populations that were in this dead center of these catastrophes. And she asked the question, what's happening here? What's going on truly? Not what you hear 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 miles away about these tragedies, but what is it like to be in the center after the tragedy has occurred? She says, as is written in this review, her answer is strangely and powerfully hopeful. She doesn't long for disasters. They are, she writes, most basically terrible, tragic, and grievous. But they are not just that. As she proves with inspired research, disasters often produce remarkable temporary communities, paradises of a soul amid the rubble, where people acting on their own and without direction from authorities manage to provide for each other. In the wake of an earthquake, a bombing, or a major storm, most people are altruistic, urgently engaged in caring for themselves and those around them, strangers and neighbors, as well as friends and loved ones. She goes on, disaster communities are remarkable societies. Just as machines reset themselves to their original setting after a power outage, so human beings reset themselves to something altruistic, communitarian, resourceful, and imaginative after a disaster. That we revert to something we already know how to do. The possibility of paradise is already within us as a default setting. See, that's what I'm saying, is that when you're in the middle of a disaster, you are overwhelmed by the vulnerability. You can't seek revenge. You can't, it's too in your face. And if you've ever been in an area that has been destroyed in that way, you'll find that even if you live on the suburbs of where that has occurred, you're drawn to go in. Something in you wants to go in and help out. There's a natural tendency to want to work for the cooperation and towards the cooperation of the people that are hurt, even if you don't know them. It's a tremendously powerful effect that human beings have that is intrinsic to each of us, to move towards the pain. You see, especially if I remember one such occasion is after the Oklahoma bombing, years and years ago, I was teaching a retreat. The bombing happened like on a Thursday, and I was teaching a weekend retreat. And I got there, and everyone was in that aura of helping and aiding and assisting. And so we had the retreat, and people would come and go out of the retreat to nurture their need to assist. I didn't need to be there. The retreat was being carried on through the embodiment of the spirit of altruism. And it was a beautiful thing to see. I suggest that that's how we could live, even devoid of catastrophes. If we allowed ourselves not to be self-protected from our pain and try to figure out ways that we can blame that pain away when we see it daily, many times in the course of the day. I don't know how many of us face people who are poor and asking for money. And oftentimes, they talk about compassion fatigue. That's not passion, compassion fatigue. Compassion doesn't fatigue. It's commentary fatigue. It's what we're telling ourselves as we move again and again into those situations. I can't handle another one. You can handle another. You just don't want to handle them. And so we find a way to sort of self-preserve our own insulation and isolation so that we don't have to feel that. As we get quiet in meditation, we begin to see the stories we have built up to protect ourselves from the pain of other people and of ourselves. We see why the emotions want to self-protect, and every time we do, we feel isolated within that protection. It's as if we stand alone while the world out there suffers. Meditation won't allow that to happen, because it keeps showing us what we're doing in order to self-protect. And once you begin to see something, you can't tolerate its obstruction, because you see that it's self-manufactured. You're doing it to yourself, for yourself, and missing something much more powerful and interconnected. So meditation opens the heart. It quiets the mind, and through the quieting of the mind and the understanding of our protective defenses, it allows us to feel more interconnected through the just the gathering of human beings around one another. And it allows you to start taking care of yourself in a way that perhaps we haven't from day one. We start feeling the same compassionate response that we would feel for the person across the room for our own pain, for the pain that we have and have lived with, and we felt have been deserving. Now, there are two aspects to opening the heart. One, as I mentioned, is keeping the front of us open, keeping ourselves, allowing ourselves to feel the vulnerability of the situation, rather than just summating the situation in some kind of resolve that allows us to turn away and forget about it. So the heart stays very fresh and open. It's as if whatever is there is willing to be felt and seen. Some of us are very good at that. Others, not so much. We're very self-protected and nothing can get in because our life has been one of trauma. And we've intentionally kept feelings out, sensing that if we allowed ourselves to feel vulnerable, we would have to re-experience some of the traumas that are engendered in our own body. But others are. Others allow that spirit of sensitivity to move them. And it's very obvious a life of both when you see the person side by side, the two people side by side. But that's only half the situation. Very few of us accomplish the second task. As I mentioned, some people are able to keep the first task, which is to stay vulnerable. Not very many, but some proportion of the population. The second task is equally as important, and almost no one is very good at it. And that is that once it comes in, you also let it go. You let what comes in come in, and you let what is there go in its own accordance, in its own time. What we like to do is romanticize it. We let the pain in, and then we just mull it over. Isn't it a tragedy? Isn't it awful? I can't. And we think that unless we're feeling that kind of prolonged romanticism of what we just saw, that we don't really care. That our caring is contingent upon that prolongation. Not true. When I was a hospice caregiver, I would go to a person's home and I would listen to the tragedy of that person dying. And sometimes it was amazingly powerful. Almost everyone had their story. Everyone did have their story. And some of them moved me very deeply. But I had to get in my car and drive to the next home where there was also someone dying. If I carried the first house imprint with me to the second house, I was not available to that second level of pain. I wasn't there. I was not. I might as well have stayed in the first house. They weren't being served, and I certainly wasn't present. What had to happen and what I learned was in the ride over, I would have to release what I had just seen and then show up anew to the second house so that I could be present to their pain, allowing it to come in, and then the third house and the fourth house. Sometimes the first house was so devastating, children dying or mother of small children dying, or you can imagine, that you want to kind of milk it. You want to sort of stay there and allow that to just be your day. But you can't, because life is moving right along with us. And everyone who's in pain deserves the presence of our mirror neurons so that they too feel connected. They too feel joined. They too feel like there's companionship in their pain. Often that's all someone wants. They don't want solutions, although that's what I often did because I was so uncomfortable being quiet. In someone's vulnerability, I would offer solutions. When someone was dying, you know, can I get you something? Do you need more pain medicines? Can I get you something to drink? What can I do for you? Is not the solution of what the person lying in bed wants. They want somebody to be with them. To do that, we have to expose the vulnerability of our presence to that person and with that person without an agenda. How many of us are willing to sit by the bedside quietly? To do so means that our own mortality is at risk because our mirror neurons are feeling what they're feeling and they're dying. Or they broke their leg, or they're terminally ill, or they just had a transplant, or they're in some ICU ward, or whatever. Or they're just a friend in emotional pain. Again, it's the question of our willingness to risk our vulnerability. You get very quiet, you see. You don't get noisy. You don't try to figure out what's the next task I can do for this person. That's just trying to put a distance between you and the vulnerability to solve the problem of their difficulty. I'll do something for you. Doing is very easy. We're very good doers. We're not very good sitting beside someone and really feeling what's going on within ourselves. There's a beautiful simpatico that comes in being able to do just that. Last week, when we had the room of the mind, I mentioned that attention was very important, the light beam, the steadiness of the light beam. But I want to add another component to that steadiness of the being. It's not just attention. It's caring attention. We are bringing caring attention to wherever the light of our attention is directed, internally or externally. That takes care of all of the hardened emotions of betrayal and disgust and blame and all of that, which can lead to a very uncaring attention. Attention by itself can be a sword. It just cuts. It's not friendly. Attention is just attention. It can be hostile. A thief is attentive. Caring without attention is just romanticism. It's wishful thinking. I sure wish you weren't feeling that. Attention with caring is the perfect combination that allows the attention that's needed to meet the vulnerability that's necessary. Because when we care, we're not protecting ourselves defensively. We're not saying, get over it. Let's move on. I've got another house too here. You're a botherer. We're allowing our attention to settle patiently, kindly. And that opens us up. That's already the state of vulnerability, the state of the undefended heart. That's the state in which things can get in. But it's also the state in which things can be released. So that once things come in, I don't mull them over endlessly. That's just, what are we doing in that? Do we not trust that love is there intrinsically in us? We don't have to keep manufacturing the love relationship by telling ourselves how awful something is. It's in the next perception, often. Let our heart naturally move to the next perception and be present there. But what about the last one? Suppose you had 30 years of last ones. What good are you? You see, you're not. Presence is presence. The moment is the moment. It's all here. This is an active experience. Love is an active verb. When we allow ourselves to open, it's an active expression of what the moment is offering. It's not the past memory. Love becomes betrayed in a memory because it's not active. It's not momentary. And therefore, it's the remembrance of love. It's not the real thing. Remembering that compassion is an active expression, immediate. Caring attention is what we bring. So I have, before I close, I want to just tell you a story. When I was also a hospice director, we would do in-services for the staff, and one of the people I brought over for in-service was a woman who had written a book about having died and had an out-of-body experience and when she had died. And so I thought, well, that's interesting, let's bring it in. We stay open to things. So this is the story she told, and I'm going to be very short here. She was young, she was in her 20s, and she was shopping in downtown Seattle, and she left the store, and she had a pulmonary embolism, and she just fell right down on the cement, passed out completely. And she left her body, and that was most of her in-service, but that wasn't what was interesting to me. What was interesting to me is that as soon as she fell, a passerby stopped and started giving her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And she said she was witnessing this a few steps away in an out-of-body experience. And she said she decided to come back into her body not because of the air he was giving her through the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but because of the compassion he was feeling for her while he was doing that. That's what brought her back into the body. This is the most tremendously powerful emotion that any of us have, is our ability to be compassionate. To feel what someone else is feeling, as if we were actually having that same experience. It connects us deeply in our humanity. It allows us to know one another as human beings. And the internal rancor, the need to form our hardened identities, and the defenses that we all have piled up against the door of that vulnerable response to life, is what meditation is attempting to address. How does it address it? Not with contempt, but with warmth and kindness. Oh, this too for me. This is happening to me. Isn't that interesting? I'm afraid. Oh, let me be kind to my fear. I'm angry. Let me feel that too. I'm so impatient with you. And this too. There's room in my heart for this too. Is there love for this too? That can be an accompanying phrase as we open more and more to all of the furniture that bars the door. And so I wish that for all of us. Thank you. Can we just sit for a minute or two? See, as you sit, is there love for this too? Is there love for this too? Whatever experience we might be having, is there love for this too? It's a very different expression of attention. And you're welcoming yourself into your heart. Okay, all. We just open your eyes. We're going to take a 5-minute break and then come back, and we're going to have a metta, M-E-T-T-A meditation that Ellen is going to lead. Metta meditation is loving kindness meditation. Loving kindness meditation sets up a whole series of different types of people that we all have opinions about. And these different types of people, when we have opinions about someone, blocks our heart. And what she's going to show is that we can release the story we have with these whole series of people and reconnect with them on a more basic level than what we usually do during the day, which is we just hold them within the contempt of our definition and our image. So we'll come back in 5 minutes.
going to make a couple comments. We're going to guide us through a somewhat formal form, sharing the form of loving kindness meditation. So we're going to kind of go through the steps. Any part of this meditation can be done for an extended period of time, for an hour long sitting or 15 minute sitting, or for a day or a week or a month or months. But we're going to just go through the steps through this half hour. Sometimes when we practice this formal meditation, some people I've noticed have what I call a kickback, a tendency to kind of squirm and not feel comfortable, and that's okay. I'd like to ask, if possible, to just try to stay seated with it if that happens. Just stay with it for this time. It's okay to have a kickback. It's okay to resist if that's what comes up. So this form of meditation is a formal meditation, and Rodney's been talking some about the natural aspect and movement of the heart. And for some of us, it's hard to access that. And so there are these formal practices that are to complement the Vipassana practice, the insight meditation that we've been learning. So this is to help support accessing our heart, our heartfelt part of ourselves, the quiet part of ourselves that we sometimes miss, and just to encourage that and support it in ourselves. So that's the aim of the meditation. The form of it is actually to use phrases. It's the repetition of phrases. And what happens with the repetition of phrases is there's a tendency to have more focus in the mind, and when the mind's more steady and focused, it becomes more calm. So there's a kind of support of calmness and concentration in the mind begins to happen with the repetition. So we're actually using words and phrases in this. So it's different. It's a different a kind of use of meditation. So just to recognize that. So one of the things I would learn when I first learned this meditation at a meditation center years ago, it's my favorite part of being able to talk about this. It's just the funny part is we would sit in the library that had books all around, and there were chairs where everybody could sit and learn and practice the meditation. And on the front door of the library, it would say, there was a sign that said, "Please, no reading in the library." That might be the only place in the world where there is a sign that says no reading. But we would sit in the comfortable chairs there that were encircling the books, and snuggle up with blankets and pillows and get comfortable. So that's a little different in the meditation for metta meditation, is that we want to be comfortable. So just check and make sure you're comfortable now. And feel free to shift your position at any time so that you are comfortable. And we're just going to begin bringing our attention inwardly. In this particular part of the meditation, I learned many years ago after a long retreat that was taught by a 93-year-old monk, Ananda Maitreya. And he led a loving kindness meditation. And he began with the body. So we're going to begin with the body. And at times I'll have quiet spaces, just a few quiet spaces throughout the meditation. And when that occurs, see if you can bring up your own phrases and say them inwardly to yourself, the metta phrases, and I'll give some examples. And I might switch a few times through the meditation the words so you can get a sense of the variation. But what you want to do is find words that resonate for you. And so when we do the repetition of the phrases, what's important is to land on each word. That's one way I like to describe it. So, for example, may there be ease in this moment. May there be ease. And so just to really land with each word, so we're really attentive. And as we begin, just see if you can bring your attention down into the center of your chest, known as the heart center. You can feel the quiet there, in that area. And so from this quiet place, we're going to send wishes of well-being. So we'll begin by, we're going to move down through the body, sending loving kindness to our bodies. When Ananda Maitreya offered this meditation, we did it for over an hour. And I think we started with the right ear, and then we moved to the left ear, and we went on through the whole body. In fact, it struck me as quite funny. You know, at first I thought it was kind of strange. But after engaging it over years, I don't see it that way at all. So let's start with feeling our head. Just feeling our head while our eyes are resting closed, allowing the body to be soft and relaxed. Feel our head as it is. Just sensing the subtlety of the feeling of our head, the top of the head, the back of the head to the right and the left, in the front, the kind of mystery of the face that's so sensitive, and then moving inwardly, sensing the inward mystery of our head, and from our heart, a simple wish, may there be ease. May there be ease and comfort in my head, just as it is. So notice if there's views and opinions, and see if we can just release the ideas that we have, and just feeling into this sense of aliveness within the mystery of our head. May there be ease and comfort in my head, just as it is. This simple wish for ease and comfort in my head. And then allowing the awareness to move down into the throat, into the sense of the neck, that which is firm in the neck, and that which is soft and tender in the neck, that which is warm and cool, that which is vibrating and just the sense of the neck, the front, the back, to the right, to the left, and inwardly, may there be ease and contentment in my neck, in my throat, just as it is. And allowing the awareness to move down and settling down across the shoulders to the right and the left, in the front of the chest, in the back of the chest, the upper chest, and then down through the right arm from the shoulder to the upper arm and the elbow, the forearm, the wrist, and into the fingers and all that makes up the hand, the right arm, the right shoulder. May there be ease and contentment in my arm, in my shoulder, in my hand, just as it is. And then allowing the awareness to sweep down to the left shoulder and arm, the upper arm and elbow, the forearm, the wrist, and the fingers. Wishing ease and contentment in my left arm, just as it is. And feeling into the upper chest, the whole upper torso, the front of the chest, the back of the chest, to the right and the left, and inwardly into the mystery of this body, and down into the hips and the sit bones that rest upon our chair or cushion, into the belly, the right hip and the left hip, and into the lower back, feeling the whole sense of this torso, inwardly and outwardly, and sensing its mystery, and from our heart, wishing grace and ease in my torso. May there be ease and grace in my torso, just as it is. And from the right sit bone, extending down through the thigh, the upper thigh and lower thigh and inner thigh, the knee, the calf, the heel, into the foot and down into the toes, the tips of the toes. The mystery of where those toes might be. Just feeling into the right leg and everything that makes up this leg, made of water and earth and fire and air, and moving down from the sit bone of the left thigh, the upper thigh, the lower thigh, and inwardly, and the knee, the calf, down into the heel, into the foot and the toes of the left foot, and the mystery, feeling the edge of our foot and toes. May there be ease and contentment in my legs and feet. May there be ease and contentment in my legs and feet. And then just feeling the whole sense of the whole body, the full body awareness. May there be ease and contentment in my body, even where there's tension and tightness. I wish for release and ease and grace. And then just sensing the sense of self, the whole presentation of mind and its intimacy with the body, the emotions and feelings. Just giving a sense of self, may I be happy May I be peaceful. May I live with ease and contentment right here, right now. A simple wish. To myself, with caring attention, may I be at peace, may I live with ease, may I be safe and free from danger. And then we're going to release ourselves and come and bring to mind someone in our life who has supported our well-being sometime in our lifetime. Just bringing to mind someone who has, you felt their generosity toward your well-being. We call this person a mentor, a benefactor. So to keep it very simple, a very uncomplicated relation with someone where you felt their caring for your well-being. So see if you can bring that person, a sense of that person here. Call the person forth so that you sense them in front of you. Welcome them here, your mentor. And this, and feeling in your heart a sense of appreciation for their generosity and caring for you. And so, we send loving kindness to our mentor. My dear mentor, may you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free from harm and danger. May you live with ease and well-being. So that, what I just shared there is what is often called a longer version. Sometimes for some people it helps to have a longer set of phrases. For others it's to have a very short, simple, it might be a word or two. And often with metta, sometimes people use the word happy, may you be happy, which is often interpreted as being content, at ease. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free from pain and struggle. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free from pain and struggle. And in turn, your mentor is sending loving kindness back to you. And so you listen to your mentor. May you be happy. May you be content. May you live with ease here and now. In taking into heart that loving kindness from your mentor. And then releasing your mentor, wishing your mentor well. And we call to mind a friend, someone you care about and you feel a gentle sense of ease and well-being. Sense, again, call forth, sense your friend here with you. their presence and heart. May you, my dear friend, may you be happy and peaceful. May you be healthy. May you be happy and peaceful. May you be healthy. And appreciating the ease of the sharing of friendship, knowing there's ups and downs and pauses, but this wish from the heart, the shared wish of well-being, and hearing your friend sharing loving kindness back to you. May you be happy and healthy and live with ease. May you be happy and healthy and live with ease. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free from mental and physical suffering. May you be safe from harm and danger. May you live with ease throughout your days. Appreciating and taking to heart this metta from your friend. And then we release our friend and wish them well. And then we call forth, we bring to mind a neutral person. And that is someone you don't know well. Someone you may just pass on your in a given day from here to there. You see regularly someone who may provide a service. Someone you see regularly but don't know, so that you don't have a strong feeling, a positive or negative feeling about them. It's kind of a neutral feeling. In fact, sometimes there's hardly a thought about them. You see them and maybe appreciate their service. But for many neutral people we encounter through our days, but let's just bring forth one and sense this neutral person here and now. And sharing loving kindness with this neutral person. May you be happy and healthy, safe, and live with ease. May you be happy and healthy, safe, and live with ease. And just allowing this generosity of heart, this wish of well-being. May you be happy. May you be healthy and safe. May you live with ease. May you live with ease. May you be free from struggle and suffering. happy, content. May you be safe and healthy and live with ease, well-being. And now releasing, wishing well this person, this neutral person, this person we don't know well, but wishing them well. And now we'll call forth one more individual. And this is someone where we feel a bit of a rub, often described as a difficult person. So see if we can just simply call forth one individual where we feel a struggle or rub in our life with them. Sometimes we may not want to choose the most difficult person, but you know, we can just kind of discern and sense what feels skillful. And just see if we can draw and call forth this person. And in so doing, seeing if we can sense our common shared humanity, that which makes us human, that we're here in a body, we both share bodies and feelings and thoughts and emotions and views and opinions, and feeling this shared humanity, this earth, this air, this sun, this water. So we simply, with the generosity of our heart, share loving kindness toward this difficult person. May you have ease. May you be healthy. May you have contentment and safety in your life. May you know ease and contentment. May you be healthy. May you know safety and ease in your life. And then sometimes if it's too difficult to work with a difficult person, we can always go back to our mentor and send loving kindness to the mentor. And you can sense how the heart begins to open again. So just being very gentle in our way of working with difficult people. Our difficult person, wishing them well, wishing them ease, wishing them the deepest sense of contentment within. In their life, on this earth, release them. And so now we'll come down and feel our body once again, where it's resting, where we're seated. We're going to just expand out this loving kindness in front of us, extending it forward and to our right and to our left. Behind us, sensing those around us, we'll expand this loving kindness outwardly from this inner quiet heart center. Out in all directions, up and down. Sharing this wish of well-being, this wish of freedom from suffering and pain. To one another gathered here and then beyond, to the north and the south and the east and the west, throughout the city, and beyond, in all directions. To every sentient being who sensates in any way, however small or however large, however feeble or strong, or young, or old, or noble, or ignoble. All those seen or unseen, those who suffer, those at ease, in all directions, may all beings be free from suffering. May all beings know contentment deeply and fully. May all beings be at peace, be at ease. And once again, coming back, drawing our attention back inwardly, gathering, coming inwardly, so we're fully here. And just closing with a simple wish for ourselves as well, not to leave ourselves out. May I know ease and contentment. In this body, in this heart and mind.
I just want to emphasize the point of metta is to look at different ways we block our sense of vulnerability with people because we have ideas about it. I can let this one in because they've helped me, they're my benefactor. Here's a friend, and that's a little more difficult because it's kind of ups and downs with friends, but still, I like them, and you can come into my heart. And then, I don't know you. A neutral person, why should I like you? I mean, because they're human beings. You see how we frame each individual in accordance with whether we want to be vulnerable to them. And then the person who has, we protested, they have some difficult deal with. We have reason to barricade ourselves from any connection to them. And so these, and there are many, many others, sections of old lovers and on. Each one, by definition, is either in or out of us. And it begins to narrow the field of where we allow ourselves the sensitivity and connection that's necessary for us to really engage in life. Some of us are so isolated that we may have just a very few people who will open to. Some of us, none, no one. Metta is an attempt to start opening that back up again. To not look at my definition of you, but to go deeper than that, at the basic humanity that we share, and that you're worthy of me connecting because you're a human being. And even deeper than that, because you're sentient, because there's a feeling there. You can feel pain, pleasure, all sentient beings. Then you start caring about animals. You start, where does that end? My God, it doesn't have to end. We can keep expanding that field and allowing ourselves to become a part of life rather than to separate and segregate ourselves away from it. May I allow this person in? They're a different ethnicity. They're a different gender. They're a different this. They're a different that. They're older. They're deformed. They're ugly. They're pretty. They're what? Where do we meet? Where do we meet? Meditation is the process of meeting. And then there's the one place where none of us meet, and that's with ourselves. We have so much contempt for ourselves because we've known what we've done, right? And no forgiveness there. We know where we've been. We know what we have done. We know what we're guilty of, the shame, the remorse. We don't move on in our life. We carry the weight of that with us. Forged through the years. We have to clean all this out to come back to a life, to the springboard of what's alive. It's here, but we're never going to get here if we stay then. If we stay in the past, reminiscing about what we could have been or what we should have done, we never arrive. Meditation is all about that arrival. It's all about showing up. It's all about renewing ourselves. And that's where the heart and the meditation meet. So this is not a heartless practice. It is a practice with heart. Keep the phrases very short so that you're used to them. May I be safe and free of danger. May I be peaceful. May I have ease and well-being. Something that fits you comfortably. And then perhaps you want to start your meditation every morning with 5 minutes of that. Just allowing yourself to come into your own heart. May I be safe and free of danger. May I be peaceful. May I have ease and well-being. Or maybe at the very end of the sitting, when your focus is stronger and the metta is more powerful, you can spend 5 minutes at the end. But throughout the day, just retraining how to include others rather than exclude them. So look at the fringe element, the marginal people who we don't even pay attention to. May you be safe and free of danger. May you be peaceful. May you have ease of well-being. And they won't even know what you're doing to them. You don't have to tell anybody. And you will find yourself, suddenly it will be like this. It's up to us, you see, which way we want to go. What do we want to do with our life? Look at the disposition of the world. Look at the disposition of the politics, our leadership. Do we want to go that way? This is a life that can be self-directed. towards a more inclusive spirit. I choose that. It's a happier life. I'm going to let us go without questions, but tomorrow or next week we'll have a long question and answer period. Next week I want to talk about how we frame the world in terms of our story and narrative and live within the depiction of that commentary, never allowing ourselves to feel or move outside of the details of our own self-speak.